Up next, a special interview with retired NASA astronaut and director, Bob Crippen.
I believe that this nation should commit itself to achieving the goal, before this decade is out, of landing a man on the moon and returning him safely to the Earth.
If the truth were known, we really delayed this launch so we could get the burritos on time.
I figured that.
The flight director says get back in.
We lost the flight plan out the window.
On all three networks, you replaced all the kitty cartoons.
Here's the only problem.
We copy you down, Eagle.
Listen, Tranquility Base here. The Eagle has landed.
I was strolling on the moon one day.
Counter, go and throttle up.
The Earth from here is a grand oasis of the big vastness of space.
You're listening to The Space Program, NASA's past, present, and future.
An interview with retired astronaut and director Bob Crippen. This is Rich Kirshner reporting. Bob Crippen became a NASA astronaut in September of 1969. He was a member of the astronaut support crew for Skylab 2, 3, and 4, as well as Apollo-Soyuz test project. He served as a pilot of STS-1, which was on Columbia, the very first shuttle flight, and he was the spacecraft commander on STS-7, STS-41C, and STS-41G. A four-flight veteran, Crippen has logged over 565 hours in space. He also served in multiple positions as directors of NASA. He now kindly joins us. We're speaking with Bob Crippen, retired NASA astronaut and director. Captain, does this conversation find you in good health?
It does. I'm in much better health than I have a right to be. I'm sure it's for all my clean living.
You are lying, right? Come on, you're prior military. You know better than that. How did you become an astronaut?
Well, I sort of slipped in the back door, not the normal method. I was a Navy guy that ended up going to the Air Force Test Pilot School. And while I was there in 65, both NASA and the Department of Defense came out requesting applications to be an astronaut. Like most of the guys at school at that time, I applied for both of them, and then it came. I stayed in the process long enough to Navy told me I had to select one or the other. I couldn't keep both as an option. So at that time, and this was in 65, NASA was working on the Gemini program and trying to get Apollo ready, and they had quite a few astronauts. So I figured, well, the best chance of flying I have is with the military on a program called the Manned Orbiting Laboratory. Which was a highly classified program. Was lucky enough to be selected for that program in 67 and went to work on it, but it got canceled in 69. It was it's kind of a long story, but NASA ended up taking everybody that was in the flight crew on MOL that was 35 and younger into the astronaut office. That was in 69 that happened, right at the time, shortly after the first moon landing.
You were the pilot on the first space shuttle mission on Columbia. Mercury, Gemini, and Apollo missions were first flown unmanned to test the systems. The first shuttle flight was an entirely different design, yet you and John Young manned that flight. I can't imagine the anxiety as you were ready to launch.
Well, somebody might have had anxiety. I think John and I were just both excited. Yeah, the space shuttle was built such that it would have been very difficult to fly it unmanned. That was debated, and both John and I lobbied that we ought to be on board for the first launch because we thought it would have a higher chance of success. That was the decision made by management, so we were lucky enough to be on the first flight.
Now, I imagine once you achieved orbit, you were probably very relieved that you didn't have to go through RTLS or AOA or any of that stuff. You just wanted to get on orbit and get it over with.
That's true, because a lot of our training, especially, was dealing with the contingency stuff like aborts, return to landing site abort. Then we had a transatlantic abort regime, and then your abort to orbit where you go in a lower orbit than what you plan. And so you know, going through all those and the engines performing great, we had a lot of problems developing on those engines because they're, from a technology standpoint, they're they were pressing it. Probably one of the surprises I had of the whole shuttle program was, of all of the missions that we flew, we only had one mission where we lost an engine. It was due to some sensor problems, but it was late enough in the flight that they still managed to make orbit.
That was a abort to orbit, if I remember right.
It was.
Yeah. Well, oh, and your transatlantic abort site was Dakar, Senegal?
Well, that flight was at Dakar.
Well, you had four flights, so it's kind of
Yeah. I actually think it was Rota, Spain.
On orbit, how did Columbia perform compared to the mission planning and your training?
Outstanding. You know, it was still a test vehicle, and we did learn some things on that initial flight. But that's why you do test flights, just so you can learn what the deficiencies are and correct them. We had somewhat of an overpressure from the solid rockets when they ignited on the pad, actually bent a strut up in the forward part of the orbiter where the fuel is held. We didn't know about it during that time. It was only found after we came back. They corrected that. Also, in the first stage with the solid rockets, that's not a closed-loop guidance at that particular point. We lofted well above the planned trajectory with both John and I could see, but going higher is better than going lower, so that was fine with us. On orbit, most of the systems worked as we'd planned. We did find that some of our thermal protection system that we call tiles on the rear end of the vehicle in a non-critical place had come off, and some people were very worried about if they'd come off on the bottom, which would have been critical, but it turns out they didn't. All in all, it was a fairly clean mission for a first test flight.
Well, you know, okay, I was on the ground side, of course, and boy, the media just went nuts when they saw those tiles missing on the OMS pods.
Well, yeah, we learned that when we got back, because it was, if there'd been any tiles missing on the bottom, it could have been catastrophic. But both John and I had known that every tile on the base of the vehicle that was critical, the system had developed a pull test where they attach sort of a plunger-like device to the tile and pull on it to a certain degree to make sure that it's properly adhered. We didn't have time to do that for all of the tiles, including the one back on the OMS pods, because they were there primarily for reusability and weren't that critical. So I wasn't, nor was John, that surprised that some of them might have come off.
And for our listeners, OMS is an acronym.
Orbital Maneuvering System. It's where main engines are on the space shuttle orbiter.
How roomy was it in the shuttle? Do you expect it to be cramped? Because I've sat in the simulator, and it seemed cramped. But on orbit, where you're floating around and you're not restrained, how did it feel to you?
Actually, it felt very roomy. And, you know, when you compare it with previous spacecrafts like the Mercury, Gemini, and Command Module and Apollo, it had quite a bit more room. You got two decks, one the flight deck and one the mid deck. There's plenty of move around, especially with just two people on board. But later in some flights where I had seven crew members, it still accommodated us very well.
Well, you were actually the commander of the first flight that had seven, if I recall.
That's correct.
After landing on the dry lake bed at Edwards Air Force Base, what are your memories of exiting the shuttle and walking around it?
Well, first, as we were coming in for the landing, and I need to clarify this because we confuse people with it, but we called the commander and the pilot,
right.
Because none of us red hot test pilots want to be called a co-pilot. In reality, the commander's the pilot and the pilot is a co-pilot. So as John was getting ready to circle over the Edwards lake bed there, He did a big left bank, and I looked out his window, and there were thousands of people out on the lake bed. And I was told, John, I hope they don't get on the runway, which thank goodness they didn't. But after we came to a stop, John did a beautiful job with the landing, and I've known John quite a few years, and I've never seen him that excited before or since. He was really happy, and he really wanted to get out of the spacecraft fairly rapidly, but the people need to make sure that there are no noxious fumes around it, so we had ground crew checking that out for us. But John was bouncing between the mid deck and the flight deck repeatedly. Meanwhile, I was having to stay in my seat and on the communication because there were switches that we needed to be thrown in the cockpit. But John came bounding out as soon as they opened the hatch. I had to stay aboard a little bit longer, but when I came out, John was still very excited. Maybe he'd calmed down a little bit, but both he and I walked around and looked at the spacecraft, and it looked in very good shape. We were both very happy. We were greeted by George Abbey and some other friends down at the base, and then the docs gave us a quick medical checkup, and they had set up this little celebration out there on the lake bed with built a podium or a stage, if you will, and all those thousands of people were gathered around, including the governor of California, which was Jerry Brown then, and he just recently got out of the second term. But we had an undersecretary of the Air Force. People were giving speeches or that kind of thing. And one of my memorable moments was when I was a kid growing up in Houston, we had a big rodeo there, and every year it would either be Gene Autry or Roy Rogers that would come and perform at the show, and I would always go down to the ringside and hold out my hand as they rode around the arena and shake their hands. And sure enough, I looked down the side of the stage we were on, and there was Roy Rogers there. So I had to walk over and shake hands with him.
Nice moment.
It was.
Yeah, I remember watching on TV, and when you guys came out of the spacecraft, which took an eternity, it seemed to be, you know, for us, what about an hour or so?
I don't think it was quite that long, but it was at least half an hour, maybe a little bit longer.
Yeah, and John came out, and man, he was doing the walk around, and he was acting like he won the World Series. He was just pumping his fists in the air and just being a kid.
From his perspective, right.
Right. I mean, this was a spacecraft unlike any other. I mean, it's massive. It's just, how do you take something from 17,500 miles an hour and land it on a dime?
Well, our engineers did a great job in designing the spacecraft, and we had a lot to learn about aerodynamics coming through those flight regimes. We did have some corrections we had to make there, our flight control system a little bit, but it really did a nice job coming back down through the atmosphere, and handled beautifully. It did handle very nice.
How was the ride down from orbit?
Surprisingly, very smooth. On the dark side, where we fired our engines to start the entry, when we got down around 400,000 feet, you started to see a nice soft pink around the spacecraft, which was, it was getting warm out there. But it wasn't a big fiery entry like the ablative heat shields that we used on our capsules. It was a soft, pretty pink, kind of like flying down a neon tube. But as soon as we burst out into daylight, you couldn't see it any longer. And the surprising thing, you know, coming in a capsule, you're usually somewhere around 5 to 6 G's deceleration. We didn't see probably more than 1.5. It's not much different than, you know, what you'd experience in an airliner coming in to land at an airport. So there was very little vibration, so it was a nice, smooth flight as far as I was concerned.
You and I can speak, you know, candidly about this stuff because I know somewhat a lot of the terminology and all that. Would you explain to our listeners why the pink glow?
Well, you're going like Mach 25. All those little air molecules start to hit your spacecraft. The way they dissipate that energy is through heat. So we built up around 3,000 degrees Fahrenheit on the nose of the spacecraft. That heat is what causes it to glow.
You're listening to The Space Program.
We're speaking with Bob Crippen, retired NASA astronaut and director. You had a rather aggressive flight assignment commanding three missions on Challenger in just 16 months. With all of the training requirements, how did you pull that off?
Well, the first two, SDS-7 and 41C, I had plenty of time to train on, up almost a full year, which is about normal. While I was training for my 41C mission, I was asked if I could take 41G, and it was only like 6 months between my flight and the 41G flight. And I actually asked management why did they want to press it so close. And, you know, we were talking about flying more shuttles than any of us imagined we could at that time. And so I was told by the director of flight crew operations, George Abbey, he wanted to see how fast he could turn crews around. So I told him, well, if I could have somebody I'd flown with to act as my flight engineer and work with the crew prior to while I was finishing up 41C, I could do that. And I told him that was Sally Ride. She flew with me on STS-7. So Sally sort of stood in for me training our crew while I was off doing my third mission. And when I finished that and got with the 41G crew, they were right where they should be. Sally done a great job getting them ready.
Well, I wasn't going to ask this, but I'm going to throw it in. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask. Sally Ride was the first United States woman to fly in space, and you flew with her twice. Can you tell us a little bit, take a couple of minutes to tell us about her?
Oh, Sally was a great gal. We had six women in the first selection in 1978 when we did select females, and all of them were great. Any of them could have taken the mission. I sort of picked Sally because we were going to have to use that remote manipulator, the arm, quite a bit on that flight to check out whether we could capture free-flying satellites. And her personality was such that she was very gregarious. She fit right in with the guys, and I knew that she'd fit in with the crew. And what you want when you put a crew together is people that are all compatible with one another. So it was a pleasure flying with Sally and then being her friend. We lost her much too early. She died in her 60s, but it was great. She did a great job every task she took on.
Well, you actually partially beat me to my next question. Did you have any input on crew assignments?
Yes, the commander has inputs, but you work them with the chief of the astronaut office and the director of flight crew operations, who in my case were John Young and George Abbey. We'd exchange ideas, talk about them as to who would best fit, and end up coming up with the crew.
Both shuttles you had flown on were lost on subsequent missions. I'm sure you were devastated both times.
Yes, that's an understatement.
Now, I was actually watching the Challenger. I raced home from my college class to catch the Challenger launch, and I was watching it live, and I just knew something was wrong when, you know, the big cloud, and I heard that static, and that meant LOS. They lost signal, and I knew something was really bad. And then they showed the SRBs flying around left and right, and that was it.
That was terrible. I was actually training for a fifth flight that I was going to do out of Vandenberg Air Force Base, and I was at Los Alamitos, New Mexico, working with the payload out there, and we'd got them to get us a TV where we could watch the launch, and we were disappointed with about 30 seconds into the flight, they cut to a soap opera.
Oh,
and we were walking out of the room saying some foul words when all of a sudden it came back on and you could see it had come apart. That was devastating, yes.
No, man, I stopped breathing probably 20 seconds. When Columbia came down, I was Columbia broke up during reentry for our listeners, and I live in Arizona, and I had projected that we could see, based on pre-dawn, we could actually see Columbia in the northern sky as it went over northern Arizona. So my lady and I, we went outside and spotted it, and gosh, 4 or 5 minutes later, it broke apart over Texas. It was just, it was devastating. It was really bad.
Yeah, the I was completely retired at that point, so I wasn't involved with the program. But my middle daughter, Susan Crippen, works at the Johnson Space Center, you know, training astronauts and working in mission control. And she gave me a call after they'd lost, you know, they didn't get contact with them. So it hadn't really been reported of all of the debris coming down at that point. But we both knew that if they'd lost contact, that they hadn't survived entry, which they hadn't.
Right. And I had NASA TV on, and my lady was getting ready to go to work, and I kept hearing, you know, Columbia, Houston, UHF, Comcheck. And I'm thinking, wait a minute, you're over the United States. You're over CONUS. You cannot lose contact. And I said, this is bad. She says, oh, don't worry, it'll be okay. And then within a half an hour, the videotape started rolling in from the public to the news stations, you know, of the streaks in the sky. And it was just, oh my gosh, you got to be kidding me. After 4 flights in 565 hours in space, you then served as director in several capacities at NASA. I'm sure you still had cravings to go back into orbit during that tenure.
Well, I was actually, as I said, I was preparing to fly a fifth flight when we lost it. That was going to be out of Vandenberg Air Force Base for the military, and that went away after the flight. But I got moved into a part of the accident investigation and ended up making a recommendation that I believe we needed more operational people in the management of the program. And I was told if I believed that I'd hang up my flying boots and come help run the program. So since I believed it, that's what I did. My first out was deputy director of shuttle operations, which primary job there was to get the shuttle back flying again, which we successfully did after a little over 2 years. Then I was elevated to director of the shuttle program, which I spent a couple of years up in Washington, D.C. at NASA headquarters. Finally moved to director of the Kennedy Space Center, which was a great job. Still not as good as sitting in the cockpit, but a great job.
You're listening to The Space Program.
We're speaking with Bob Crippen, retired NASA astronaut and director. How do you keep busy these days?
I don't know what I do, but I'm always busy. But I'm fully retired now. And when I initially retired, I spent a lot of time fishing down here in Florida, which I dearly love to fish. But after about 12, 13 years, it got to seem more like work than fun. So I gave that up as well. But we do a little bit of traveling. I like to read and keep abreast of what's going on in the space program.
Well, this is the last question, and I ask this of all of our guests. What's your favorite food, and what do you want for Christmas?
What is my favorite food? Oh, I think my favorite food would be beer. What do I want for Christmas? Well, I have my two front teeth, but let's see. What I want for Christmas is to not be traveling and have a nice, quiet Christmas with my wife.
Well, that's fair enough. Captain, thank you very much for your time. From Sun Sounds of Arizona, Godspeed in all of your endeavors.
Thank you very much.
An interview with retired astronaut and director Bob Crippen. This is Rich Kirshner reporting.
From the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, and God bless all of you. All of you on the good earth.
This has been The Space Program, NASA's past, present, and future.